The Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio is on the air.
Hello, is this Mike?
Yeah, hey, Gene.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing really good. Thanks for the opportunity. How are you?
Great. Sorry you had to hear that weird intro there, but it was exactly on.
It was kind of cool. I think this is what I'm doing.
How's everything out there in San Francisco?
It's okay. It's a little too hot for me right now, but it's okay. We're above ground. It's a good day.
You know, that story is true. We have this local station. People are telling me, oh, you got to check out the local metal station. It's on because I was like, midnight metal was only on Saturday night, things like that.
Uh-huh.
And they said, oh, no, we got a station that's on all the time. They had a really old transmitter. It was coming out of a college.
Yeah.
So I could never get the damn thing in. It was like kind of weak and whatever. So the first day I did in, it was like summer 87. And the second song they played was Feel of Magic. And I'm like, oh my God, this is it. Now I know I am metal.
Oh my God. Really?
Seriously.
Wow.
So it's your fault.
I take full responsibility. That's great. That's awesome.
All right. So I guess if you're ready, we'll try to get started.
Yeah, I'm ready.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema, your source for in-depth discussion of cult cinema. Tonight we're talking music with legendary Lever Leone of Chastain and Sledge Leather on the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. Focuses on film that matters, cult, grindhouse, drive-in, independent, and underground film from the dawn of the talkies through the early 90s. Tonight, we're talking metal, and we'll be speaking with one of the greatest of all female metal singers, legendary powerhouse Lever Leone. As frontwoman for Chastain and no less than five records between 1985 and 1991, her dramatic, Dio-inspired pipes both complimented and drew some much-deserved attention to David T. Chastain's darkly melodic neoclassical guitar work, resulting in what many outsiders agree may be five of the strongest metal records ever recorded. After a staggering two-decade absence from music, and in honor of her late mentor, Lever's return to the fray sounded just as powerful as the day she left. Having been involved with drummer Sandy Sledge and two other all-female projects, Rude Girl and Malibu Barbie, Lever's reunited with her old bandmate to deliver a haunting yet hard-hitting slab of traditional steel that gives more than just a nod to the classics, filtered through a postmodern crunch. Join us as we speak to the one and only Lever Leone here on Third Eye Cinema. In our first segment, we'll be speaking about Rude Girl, Ronnie James Dio, and Chastain. But first, just to give you an idea of what we're referring to, here's some classic Lever. This is the title track of her 1988 solo album, Shockwaves. We'll be right back. Tonight, we're talking music, and we have with us, hands down, one of the greatest female vocalists in metal. While primarily known more to hardcore aficionados of the scene due to the underground status of the band she spent the better part of her career fronting, this woman is practically unparalleled in terms of sheer power and control, able to deliver some hard-edged attack with a tender, proper vocal training finish. Now back together with a woman who backed her up on the drums in no less than two separate bands, she's returned to the fold after two decades of complete retirement from the music scene and sounding just as good as the day she left. Ladies and gentlemen, allow me to introduce one of my personal favorite vocalists and a true legend in metal circles, Miss Leather Leon. Leather, welcome to Third Eye.
Thanks a lot. That's awesome. I need you every day in my life for me to wake up with that type of introduction. But thank you. It's me. It's really me. But yeah, thank you so much.
So you originally worked together with Sandy and Rude Girl with Lois LaRue on guitar and Delphine Knight on bass. I don't believe you guys put out any demos or albums during that time, but...
We did not, but I mean, there certainly is a demo floating around. Probably not, because it's a different time now. We have the demos tucked in secure in our closets, of course, but we actually never got to that point. We were at SRI with Sandy Perlman, who was such a hot shot at the time, the Sabbath guy, I believe, and we did a run-through because he wanted to hear the material, and I can remember the plan was for us to go in and do three songs. Well, Sledge and I just kept going. We did the whole record, but you know, again, it was a different time. I don't think anybody has that but us, yeah.
And it wasn't an all-girl band. Those are kind of rare even to this day, but much more so at the time, especially in metal, because, you know, you had the Runaways who were great, but they were more of a rock glam thing. You had Girl School in the UK, but that was about it.
Yeah, oh my God, Girl School. Oh my God, we had such crazy freaking times with them. Yeah, I guess. I mean, I had known about Leather Angel, right? There was Leather Angel.
Oh, yeah.
And then, yeah, and you know, I don't think about it like that. I'm like a genderless type person. But yeah, I guess it was. But I got to tell you, being in bands, these girls rocked harder than any freaking dude I know. So, but you know, we had to work harder back then. You know, we were just young and stupid and convicted. But it was an all-girl band.
Yeah, because, I mean, later down the road, we got bands like Phantom Blue, Vixen, Mean Street,
and Malibu. It's funny about Phantom Blue. Phantom Blue, yeah. Mike Varney called me up one day, and he goes, I found the new Leather. And he had turned me on to Phantom Blue when they were doing Shrapnel stuff. So, yeah, I mean, they got signed to Geffen, right? They didn't really do too much, but they did get a big record deal initially.
Yes, they did. But I was going to say, Malibu Barbie, you're also involved with Sandy again. But like I was saying, you know, distaff involvement in hard rock and metal was sort of few and far between, particularly when you go beyond bands that, you know, they had a female singer, but the rest of the band were guys.
I know. I listened to that Malibu Barbie stuff, and I mean, they were just so ahead of their time. You know, I take a little credit for that. That was Sledge's band with all her friends, and I had just been home from the road, and they called me and said, hey, can you come down and just do these two tracks? And I'm like, sure. You know, I mean, Sledge came and picked me up, and I mean, I didn't know the material, and I was always in a rush. I gotta go. You know, Sandy would sing the melody in one ear, and I would sing it. I mean, God, that sounds pretty good, but those girls were very Metallica-based. They just rocked. And that EP is really popular, yeah.
So who were your inspirations? What led you to get up on stage and kick ass at a time when, you know, most females are more likely to be influenced by stuff like Madonna or maybe a new wave act?
Ronnie James Dio.
Start, huh?
I went to audition for Rude Girl, and I had been from upstate New York. I was from more of the arena rock sound, you know. Again, I don't even think about it really as women, but of course I liked Annie Wilson. I liked Stevie Nicks, but I was listening to a lot of Boston, you know, Journey, of course. And I went and I sang the Zeppelin song that Annie, that Hart had done. And Sandy said to me, hey, can you know who the guy from AC/DC is? I said, yeah. She goes, can you try singing more like that? And I was like, sure. So, I mean, I did it. I don't think it sounded very good, but of course they were really excited about it. So we just started working together. And shortly thereafter, I mean, I must confess, I'm a late bloomer as far as Ronnie goes. And when they put on, you know, Heaven and Hell, and then he came out with Holy Diver, it was over.
Right.
I was so moved by his vocal quality that I just sang in a basement for a year and a half, and decided that's where my expression came from. Yeah, you know, the little deeper growl type of thing.
And I was just actually going to get to that. You said numerous times that your number one vocal inspiration was another real powerhouse, Ronnie James Dio, who actually had at least one early encounter with during your time with Rude Girl.
Yeah.
So, tell us about that.
I had a few, and he was... God, he was so kind and so warm to everybody. He opened up his arms to anyone. He made everyone really feel good. But he liked the Rude Girl material, and I was blessed enough to see him thereafter. And he obviously really liked what I did and told me to keep going. And I asked him how he did it, and I remember that he told me that it's something that you would acquire, you know, as you get older, that you just found your peace of mind and that your vocals would come from that. So that's why I went away for 20 years. I had to find it. he was such a gracious man. Yeah, I mean, I still listen to him. He's like the only person I listen to.
I was another one of those guys whose vocals were extremely distinctive and whose presence on any given project lent a veneer of class and worthiness that the material might not have justified with a lesser singer. Everything from the boogie shuffle he was doing with Elf to the progressive rock he did with Terry Lipkin's first solo record to Black Sabbath, Dio, and Inhabited Hell. And he was also a producer of some note who'd been involved with some material for Hellion, Rough Cut, Hearing Aid, and of course,
Dio. He did a lot of stuff. He was really, really supportive of women. I know that. I mean, he was just a multi-talented, creative person. I mean, it's so sad that he's gone, but he did a lot of things, yeah.
But beyond being an inspiration in terms of his vocal style, did you look to him as a mentor at all? Because I've always heard good things about him personally. From stories I heard, he seemed to have been very Italian in that respect, and he was very giving and open.
Oh, yeah, and I'm Leone, so, yeah, he was always... Yeah, he was amazing. I mean, we'd sit down and have a beer, and we'd talk about life. And I mean, he, I mean, you know, I was young back then, and I just kind of looked at him with stars in my eyes. And he just used to kind of do like the fake air slap around my face and say, you know, Leather, we're all talented. You're good. You're great. Keep going. You know, don't. But he just kept telling me, you'll find yourself. You'll find yourself. And I obviously say that I was trying to be Ronnie James Dio probably for the first three Chastain records.
Right.
But then, you know, you just kind of develop into your own thing. But yeah, I mean, he gave me a lot of advice. Yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, I'd always heard things about that, so I really was curious, you know, does he really give this kind of time to people that, you know, maybe just starting out?
He really did. He did. I mean, he would do it to everybody. I would be backstage at his shows, you know, I'd get the half hour or some. I mean, he did the mingle. He didn't mess around. He talked to everybody sincerely, looking at them, really listening to them. I mean, he was an incredible person, yeah.
Nice. I understand that Ruger were on the verge of inking a deal for a record, but the band fell apart before it could happen. What was the story behind that?
I'm glad you're saying that to me, Annette Sledge. Yeah, I always say to her, I just think it was not the right time. You can't go back and say, oh my God, what could have been, but we did have, actually Sledge brought it out to me when I was in LA a couple of weeks ago. She still has a copy of it. It was pretty scary. But yeah, it was a deal with CBS. And it just didn't work out. I don't know. She said that they were actually late at the lawyer's office that day, and I had got upset and ran out. But I don't know. Like I said, I don't look back and regret. It just did not work out, and we just kind of went on to do our own thing.
How did you get together with David Chastain? Were you actively sending demos around to other bands, or did he catch one of Rude Girl's shows, or was this another Mike Rainey creation?
You know it. Yeah, oh, my God, no. I'm still a lazy person. I wasn't sending anything out to anybody, but Mike had become a friend of ours, especially to me. I mean, we used to talk all the time, and when the Rude Girl project fell apart that time, he said, hey, you know, I know this guy who is veering more toward a female singer, because he had actually heard someone, and God, I'm sorry, I can't think of her name, but she was a great R&B singer that Varney was a friend of. Jennifer Hall, I think. But anyway, Chastain had said to him, you know, I think I really want to go this way because the stuff I'm writing would sound better in the keys with a woman. So he must have sent him some Rude Girl stuff, and then, of course, back then it was cassette tapes, right? And then he sent me
right.
Mystery of Illusion and Winds of Change, and, you know, that would be back in the day when you would go into the bedroom in a four-track and record it. So it was
right.
Through Mike Varney, yeah.
Yeah, because Varney was famous for signing a good guitarist and a good singer individually and then putting them together more or less at random.
Yeah, he was amazing for that. It's surprising to me. I was just watching the metal show the other day, and about how, of course, you know, he was such a deep thing in the beginning of the metal scene. I mean, how many people know about him and the great people that came out of his discovery.
Right, because I was going to say, sometimes it's pure gold, like with Racer X or Chastain, but I know sometimes it didn't work out for the people involved, like with Steeler, as great as that album was. So I gather you got on well with David?
Oh, sure. But, I was young then, and I didn't really... God, it sounds so cheesy, but I mean, I knew that I wanted to sing, but I didn't really have this path all laid out. And it's like, oh, you just sing in bands, and then you start playing coliseums. And, you know, David and I had a really business-like relationship, and when he decided that he liked my voice, he basically had 7 records written, and I really liked what he was doing at that time. I liked that neoclassical kind of weirdo Armageddon kind of thing. But, you know, so now that I think back of it, it was really, really business. But, I mean, it worked. You know, he didn't mess around. This was a job. This is what you do. We'd show up. We'd get our paychecks. We'd rehearse. We'd tour. I mean, it was, you know, we just did our job. It was a job.
Yeah, because you stayed with Chastain for what are pretty much considered to be his best albums. He's remained pretty prolific.
Well, thank you.
With everything from like Spike and CGSS to his instrumental projects, and then he has another version and a totally different style with Chastain. But most people, myself included, really just love the 5 albums he did with you.
Well, you know what it is? I haven't really listened to many of the other Chastain records till recently. And the music was just really different. You know, it was the 90s.
Very different.
And you know, he's such a prolific writer. He just writes different stuff all the time. And, you know, and you know, I am not comparing myself to this in any way, shape, or
no,
form.
No.
But think about it, when Ronnie went to Sabbath, I mean, he got creamed. Are you kidding? How do you walk into a huge band as a new singer, you know, a new writer? I mean, it's just, you get slammed. So, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of people that like the second Chastain just as well also. I mean, I just think he's blessed to have that musical career, you know, and me to be part of it.
Right, because, I mean, what you did with him, those are some really strong records. And it actually brought both Fred Curry and Ken Mary to national prominence well before their stints with Cinderella, Fifth Angel, and Paul Terry.
You know, I was in L.A., and I was at the tour supply place somewhere in Pasadena, I think, or I don't know, somewhere. And I was with Sledge, and there was some gentleman there who was really great, and he had known who I was and was talking to me, and something came up about Fred Curry. And he goes, hey, you know, Fred is just over there. That was his studio over there. So I just saw Fred, and I didn't realize. That's what he said to me. He goes, do you remember back in the day that Chastain was all pissed at me when I left? And I said, I really don't, you know. I was in my own ego head. He said, I was 16 years old, Leather. I got a call from Ozzy Osbourne. Of course I had to leave. So, yeah, a lot of people did really well.
So tell us a little bit more about your time with that band, because I understand that David knew exactly what he wanted in the studio.
You know, he did, but we were so on the same wavelength at that time. I certainly couldn't work with him now because there's a different way that I want to express myself. But, yeah, I mean, and it's funny. I mean, everyone thinks that, like, he was, you know, the leader and blah, blah, blah. But still, I could still go in the studio and do my own thing, you know, within his little
right.
box. I mean, he just let me do whatever I wanted to do.
Nice.
He'd be like, okay, here's the melody. What is it? And we used to go in and record at really wee hours of the morning. We were both early night people, which we still are. So we'd be in there 12, 1, 2, 3, and it would just be him and me and the producer, and we would just whip this stuff out. I mean, I don't know. We just worked really well together. There was no bullshit. There was no fooling around. I mean, you know, I was just... And again, I was in a world, I was just really trying to prove myself and, you know, show myself off. And, I mean, we worked really well together.
That's
you know, we
true.
Didn't have any money, Gene, so those things were, you
know,
they were
true.
Cut quickly, you know.
And it's amazing.
I mean,
so
we would do those whole records. Geez, I don't want to say 8 hours, but, I mean, they, you know, in a week they'd be done, you know.
Wow. Because, you know, the production is so lush, and these records really hold up. So it's like, wow, you tell me that you ran through it that quick.
Yeah, and it's funny that you say that, because, oh, my God, the production sucks. Come on. When we were doing Imagine Me Alive up here at Trident with Juan Ortega, the guy that did Machine Head, oh, my God, I can't wait to work with him again. But, you know, we would have conversations with him before the record and what we were trying to achieve and blah, blah, blah. And I just said, dude, you have to record me properly. None of that 80s reverby crappy. But he's like, oh, my God, but that's what we all love, you know?
Yeah, I know. I love that. So.
Sometimes I do, but vocally, it was just horrible. But you know, it was the time. Everybody did it.
Exactly. Now, this may or may not be true from what you're telling me, so just bear with me for a second, and then you can put the reality into the situation. One thing that I always found quite notable about Chastain and the band, at least for the time period that we're talking, is that I think the band was probably the only one pre-Pro Tools and the home recording revolution that, to my understanding, seldom if ever actually got together to record. Because I recall reading some interviews with David stating that, you know, each member would lay down their respective tracks from a local studio.
Yeah.
You know, every band member being spread out around the country. It was like, I think you were out
yeah.
in San Francisco. Ken Murray might have been out in Los Angeles. David and Mike Spanheim
yep.
might be in Ohio. So, you know,
yeah.
I know it was really odd for the era when most bands were like, you know, friends and local musicians. This
right.
was the only
was
band I ever heard of using
not,
this.
It's not odd any longer, but back then it
no.
probably was. Yeah, and again, I mean, we didn't have a lot of money, so you laid down your tracks or you could lay down your tracks, you know. And, of course, we had Shrapnel out here, and,
right.
you know, he had his studios back there. But, yeah, we were never in the same room together. Never!
How
no,
did
I always did my vocals with me, Chastain, and a producer, yeah.
I was going to say, how did that work out in practical terms, particularly with this such strong material coming out as the end result?
Well, it's not, I mean, you know, we would hear it. We would do, Chastain and I always did demos. He would always lay down a guitar track, and I would sing them in his bathroom and or his living room. I mean, we just used to, just every day, be down in Ohio. So people, you heard the demos. Chastain said, this is what I want you to do. So it's not like anybody did it blindly, you know.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, they learned
wow.
the song, so.
But still, like I said, that's really fascinating. And now it's kind of normal because Pro Tools and home recording has really improved. But at the time, it was like, what?
And I miss it, man. I miss being in the same room with people. It's just saying to Sledge, why can't we just in one big open room like the Doors? And even U2 did it recently and just record, but yeah, it's not the way it is.
You know, I'm not sure how much it was due to your powerful vocals versus his neoclassical but legato playing style, but if you ask anyone who really knows metal, those five albums you did are considered some of the greatest records in the genre. I mean, you never really cracked the mainstream, quote-unquote, but you always had a tremendous amount of respect among the fans who knew you, even in the dark days of the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm finding now, which, I mean, it's just so humbling. I mean, when I walked away from it, it was kind of like, well, you know, I was always proud of it, but it's like, whatever, it was just a record. But you're right, the amount of people that, just out of respect alone, that are talking to Sledge and I, and I mean, it's, you know, I was just young, floating around going, oh, okay, you know. I mean, yeah, I'm so proud of that stuff. I mean, that is really cool.
The material is also really dark and more grounded in modern day reality than many of your peers at the time. So how much are you involved in the lyrics, if not the music? Because your name does appear on several song credits, at least from the 7th of Never Onward.
As time went on, I did write more and more. I would just submit stuff to him, and then by the time, of course, For Those Who Dare, and my solo record. But yeah, I mean, I got into it more and more, which is what I find I do as an artist. I don't, like, you know, Sledge is such a prolific songwriter, so she's just kind of coming up with other stuff right now. And I don't know if it's my brain, but it takes me kind of a while to let stuff go. And I can remember by the time Voice of the Cult came around, I mean, I was just, you know, all this stuff was coming out. And he was wide open to that. I noticed that Katie, the other day, I was reading something about her, and she was saying that she kind of wanted to be more creative and stuff with the Chastain stuff. And I never, then again, you know, I didn't play an instrument, so maybe it was different for me, but I never really found that any idea that I gave him or did, he'd be like, fine, let's use it, you know?
David tended to prefer to let the albums speak for themselves. I don't recall seeing any real Chastain tours, at least not out this way in the tri-state area. And, you know, trust me, I've been front row center if I knew about one. But you did do some touring. Was it more limited, or did you focus more on Europe?
No. We just did the big loop. We did New York and Jersey and then, you know, the Midwest. And, I mean, we just went around and around and around.
I can't believe I missed you if you were out in New York and New Jersey, because I was like,
I can't even think of the names of the clubs, but we were always in New York and Jersey, yeah.
Damn.
At least once a year. That was always to me. And of course, I can't think of the clubs, but most of them are gone now. Yeah, but we basically do the East Coast and the West Coast, and then of course, you know, Texas. I mean, people still love us in Texas, and yeah, it was a fun time.
I am really kicking myself for that, because I figured, well, maybe you were touring more in Europe, or maybe you had like a limited round that you did, or...
No, you know, he never wanted to he didn't want to travel. I mean, we went to France one time, and it was just a freaking nightmare. And then really after that, he was done, you know, he just...
Right.
You know, he always had a different idea of success or what he wanted to do. He was happy just us playing, you know, like the whole Dayton, Cincinnati area, which, you know, I mean, we did really well there, but, and I think he did it to give me a chance, but he never really wanted to be far away from home. And it was hard. I mean, you know, it was hard times.
Well, sure.
Like it is now. It's no different.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with our guest tonight, Liv Leone of Chastain. In our next segment, we'll be talking about Shockwaves, Malibu Barbie, and For Those Who Dare, and leading music for 2 decades. Here on Third Eye Cinema. Special request from the lady herself. This is one of the strongest tracks off Shockwaves. This is Something in This Life. We'll be right back. about the solo album Shockwaves. How did that come about? Because it fell right between Voice of the Cult and For Those Who Dare, and you also had David as producer on it.
Yeah, well, let me tell you how that happened. It was all about Roadrunner, and I should be careful because a lot of these are my good friends. I think it was really just something that they did kind of to lure Chastain in. They wanted the Those Who Dare record, and Chastain said that it was his idea. I really don't remember, but I can remember kind of thinking, you know, that was when we'd been on the road for a while, and of course, you know, I had known about Doro, but Doro had really started to break, and the Femme Fatale girl came out, and I'm like, what the shit? I mean, why am I? What's up, you know? And he said that he was the one that said, why don't you do a solo record? Okay, so that came about, and like I said, Roadrunner made me believe, but then again, I was so young at the time that they were really going to push it. I can remember saying to them, great, let me be the lead afford of your label, let's really push this, blah, blah, blah. And I mean, it didn't, you know, I can remember it got all this airplay, and I mean, they never even pressed any of it up, so it was kind of a joke, I think. I really like that record, I still listen to it, and I'm really proud of it, because I wrote most of that, but it, you know, and again, I can't believe the people that still talk about it now, so, because it has been re-released quite a bit.
Yes.
Everybody grabs it and re-releases it. So it is out there. But Chastain said, again, that he did it to kind of give me a platform. But at the time, I was so into music that was so much like the Chastain stuff anyway. I didn't really know how different it was. And again, I kind of let him take over and, you know, produce it. And then he got Michael Harris. So, you know, I should have had more in a hand in it. But I think vocally, anybody who sings realizes that it's a lot different than the Chastain stuff. But
I mean,
it was a great opportunity, yeah.
I did notice that your vocals were more front and center. And I mean, it should be because it's a solo album, but that was one of the things that stood out to me. I was like, you know, I think she's actually throwing more into this record than she was doing with Chastain.
Yeah, I listened to it now, and oh, yeah, I was. Yeah, my heart was into that. But, you know, again, nothing happened with it. And then For Those Who Dare, you know, got all this hype, and, you know, MTV did hook onto it for a while. But, you know, it's all, you know, when you're young, you just kind of sit around and go, oh, great, Coliseums are coming, you know. But that's what happens. But again, I'm so proud of it all. I mean, you're talking to me about it, so, you know, it definitely inspired someone.
In many ways, the album's very similar to the Chastain material, like you were saying, but there's a little more open space to it. You know, Michael Harris had a very different playing style than David.
He did give me a lot of space, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was still in the neoclassical realm, but it was more stiff. It left a lot more breathing room, especially in the solos. He kind of reminded me.
And I really tried to be more, I read one of the best compliments about that really recently, that I sounded genderless on a lot of that material, and that was my thing.
That's true.
And yeah, I mean, because you know what? You know, I can stand there with the big boys, so that was really important for me to do that record, yeah.
I'll tell you something, just, you know, not scripted, just off the cuff. My drummer had a big thing for you, right? And I was like,
really?
Leather? No, because I'm used to listening to the music, and that voice, like you said, it was very genderless. I'm like, nah, that can't be. No way. But, you know, he was totally into you.
Well, we've been doing a lot of interviews lately, and, you know, people always throw the frickin' gender card at you. And I'm saying to people, look, I've never been the hot girl. I've just been the girl next door that wears boots and jeans. I mean, so it's not a problem for me. Doro needs to look hot till the day she dies, because that's how she's been put out there. You know, it's the beauty of me, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and it had nothing to do with the way you look. You're a good-looking woman. It's just the point of, like, I was listening to the music. I'm like, you know, that doesn't sound like a girl singing. It's not like, oh, yeah, I want to go on a date with this girl. I was just like,
Thank you. I always used to say that. I'd be in all these things in magazines, like the top five girl singers. And I used to say, you know, I used to talk to Ronnie about this. When you can tell me I'm a great singer, call me. I don't care that I'm a woman. I don't see the charts of the greatest male singers. I mean, to this day, it still bothers me. Who cares? You know?
Exactly. And that's kind of what I was trying to get at there. I was like, you actually did achieve that. And I was like, no, this girl kicked your ass.
Thank
She's
you.
Not like
really
going to date with her.
Bring your baseball bat, yeah.
Right.
And actually, the first two Chastain records, it was a different sound, but, you know, there weren't any pictures of us. But yeah, I was still kind of girly on those records, yeah.
But speaking about Michael Harris' playing style, he actually reminded me a bit of Mark St. John from Kiss's Analyze. There was that same sort of, I don't know, slight awkwardness to the phrasing when he played. So
yeah, it was. You said it perfectly. It was an awkwardness. Would you believe I never even met him?
Really?
Yeah. Wow. Never met him. I would talk to him a couple times when Chastain would be talking to him about guitar parts, and I would be like, let me talk to him. It's my record. But I never met the guy. Yeah.
But didn't he and the drummer get carried over to Chastain for Those Who Dare?
No.
Oh, it was the bass
Michael
player.
Harris was not.
Okay, that was it. You're right.
It could be. It's funny, I was saying that to David the other day, that, you know, you kind of go through that as a band. Like we were saying, back in the 80s, it was more of a tribe, and everybody lived together and hung out, and it's really not like that anymore. And I find myself getting really frustrated. But I said to Chessy, and I guess that's what we did. Every year we had a different band. I guess, you know, the realm of it was him and me,
right,
which now it's Sledge and I. But, yeah, it's a different time, and, you know, people need to make money. But, yeah, we had a different band every tour.
But overall,
which I totally forgot. Thanks for reminding me. Well, no, you know what happened? John, Luke Hebert, and David Harbour from For Those Who Dare, and my solo record, they got picked up by King Diamond. They toured with him for a long time.
Right. So overall, beyond what we've already touched on, how do you feel your approach on that album was different from what you were doing with Chastain? Because it was different.
My solo record?
Yeah.
I can remember I used to stay with the lighting guy in his apartment, and I would kick him out of his own place, and I just had, you know, cassettes and cassettes and cassettes of music, and I just sat there by myself with a pot of coffee, and I think I was just so amazed that somebody gave me the opportunity to kind of write my own stuff. I mean, I just did it. I did it really quickly. The first thing that came to my head, I didn't overanalyze anything, and we went into the studio, and I mean, it just worked. And of course, Still in Your Eyes, you know, I'm a huge ballad singer, so that was,
right.
You know, Chastain had that song, and, you know, I had that Shockwaves from the guy from Mark Shelton from Manila Road, who I'm still in touch with.
Right.
I just went in, and it was balls to the walls, going, you know, hey, you know.
So
I didn't want a picture
just
of me on it anywhere. I'm like, just let's freaking do this, you know.
And yet the album's loaded with pictures of you.
I know. Especially the more they re-release it. It's like, you know, all the stupid pictures. Oh, my God. That's funny.
Did you find any real difference in how things were handled or your reception as you switched from Shrapnel to David's label Leviathan to Roadrunner?
Yes. When I went to David's label, of course, you have to understand, I walked into a band that was extremely regionally successful. So I think my first show with Chastain was at a place called Bogart's in Cincinnati for 2,000 people. So the respect was already there, you know, and of course, at that time and that age for me, it brought me up to his level, so it really helped me. But it was kind of like I walked into this legacy that I had to figure it out, and I was ready. I mean, I was never worried about it. And then from Leviathan, when we did that one Roadrunner record, I mean, it was pretty sick. I mean, the crowds got bigger. The people knew me when I went to shows. So, oh, yeah, I mean, you know, the masses. I mean, I had that machine behind me for a day, you know. Yeah, it was pretty intense. But then again, I thought that it would really promote and uplift the band, but, you know, it didn't really.
Okay, this is actually kind of a joke question. That I was like, do I ask her or not? But I'm going to ask it anyway. When you had the photo shoot for Those Who Dare, you have one shot in the middle where you're dressed in rainbow suspenders, and it kind of looks like Mookie from She-Ra.
I'm sorry, what does it look like? What'd you say?
You ever see the cartoon She-Ra from the 80s? It was like the He-Man knockoff, and they had this little
character called... No, is that what I look like?
They had this character called Lookie, and he had rainbow suspenders.
Yeah, I remember. And I had the T-shirt on from the Stud, the club here in
right,
San Francisco.
Exactly. I was like, what was that all about?
I know, isn't that just horrible?
That's the only one I was like,
do you believe that somebody didn't
thinking?
Say, Lev, take the shit off? But, you know, back then it was, you know, color.
That's what it was.
I know. I have to look into that. But, yeah, that's pretty embarrassing. And my arms are folded like, you know, like an Indian or something.
I think you're actually holding the suspense out. Like.
Oh, yeah, anyway. There was you know, where the hell did I get those freaking suspenders? And where are they now, Gene?
Got to dig them out.
Yeah, that's a funny photo.
So. You were also somewhat involved with Sandy's new band, Malibu Barbie, at the very least the 12-inch, which I've seen some people refer to as the Rude Girls 12-inch, but I don't believe it had an actual title, with Lords of the Night and When Lightning Strike. And this
it was called Rude Girls, yeah.
Okay. This came right around the same time as Seventh and Never, and you had Lois LaRue from Rude Girl guesting on the solo for Lords of the Night, and it was pretty much a band reunion. How did you get involved with this little project? Did she just call you up when you were taking a break? Or?
Exactly. That's exactly what she did. She called me up and said, you know, we're over here. I don't even remember where I lived at the time, San Francisco, over here in Marin. She's like, I'm going to come pick you up. I want you to do this stuff. And I'm like, oh, okay. And like I said, it was done in an hour. I mean, that's the beauty of that stuff. You don't mess around. You go in. I was just wailing. I think vocally I was really at a peak then. Around Seventh and Never, I was like, mother, I can do this. I'm ready. And yeah, I mean, we just whipped it out. And I think we had a cup of coffee and she dropped me off and I went back on the road. I said, bye, thanks, love you. I mean, because they had a singer, but I don't know if Steve wasn't available at the time. It was just, everything was just so cut and dry back then. We didn't have the luxury that bands have now. Yeah, it was all done so fast. Literally, I'm probably exaggerating. Okay, maybe 2 hours. I mean,
wow.
Yeah.
You know, we're still talking about this stuff years later, and it was like, oh, yeah, we just did it in like 20 minutes, 2 hours. Like, okay.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I mean, it's like I said, you know, I can remember saying to Sledge, God, I didn't want to embarrass you in front of the band, but, you know, I don't know this stuff. I've never heard it. And I am not lying. Literally, she would sing me the melody. They'd turn it on. I'd sing it. And, I mean, and then I'd, you know, go off a little bit. And, I mean, it just worked, didn't it? Oh, my God.
Well, it did. It did.
Yeah,
now,
pretty.
After Shockwaves and For Those Who Dare, you finally seem like you're about to get that long-deserved breakthrough, and yet that was it. So what happened? Was it related to the whole grunge and aggro thing that essentially killed metal in the 90s, or was there other...
I don't know. I don't know. For us personally, it's funny. I was thinking about that because I knew you were going to ask. Everybody does, and I kind of get all, you know, thought-provoking and blah, blah, blah. But you know what? There was nothing going on for me. I mean, that's what the bottom line was. I could get meetings in L.A., and everybody wanted me to change. They wanted me to be more pop. They wanted me to do more, to be more sexual. It's bullshit. That wasn't me. And I would try to audition for a few bands, and, I mean, guys would, like, what are you kidding me, leather? You know? So I think I wasn't willing to change anything, so I
right.
just said, okay.
You would be surprised
yeah.
at how many, especially female singers that were in metal, tell me the exact same story. Oh, yeah, they
oh,
wanted
yeah.
me to change. They wanted me to go pop. They wanted to make the image sexier. And it's like,
yeah. I actually was just reading that about someone today. God, was it Debbie Gunn or something who said that? And I'm like, yeah, I'm just going to start saying it because I try to be all positive and blah, blah. Yeah, there were no doors open for me. You know,
wow.
Chastain and I, we had, you know, run our course and, you know, the shows started getting smaller and smaller and the economy was bad back then also. And, you know, people were going to pay $20 to go see Metallica and not 10 to come see me. And, but yeah, I mean, I can remember talking to Elektra and what was it? There was Arista back then. And yeah, they
right.
all wanted me to do something else. I mean, between you and me, and of course people that are going to read or see this interview, I was doing demos for Vixen. I was doing demos for there was a woman named Gina Demos who was a girlfriend of Tony McAlpine, who was
right.
a freaking phenomenal guitar player, but they were all pop rock songs, and I was actually doing that for people.
Wow.
And then I was just like, wow. I mean, and obviously it didn't work. That wasn't me, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Listen to Third Eye Cinema with a special guest tonight, Liv Leone from Chastain and Sludge Leather. And coming up is our final segment. We'll be here on Third Eye Cinema. Final segment, we'll be talking about Leather's time at veterinary medicine and Sledge Leather. Apropos of that, let's play the title track from Sledge Leather. This is Imagine Me Alive.
Imagine me alive, and if you close your eyes, you'll see me.
I understand that you got involved in veterinary medicine. As an animal lover myself, I think that's great, but it's quite a switch, no?
Oh, I don't know. Is it? I got into pit bull rescue and stuff. I think pit bulls and metal are pretty much the same. I did that for a while. Yeah, those are two things I always liked as a kid and as an adult, you know, music and animals. So, yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, I just find it hard to picture someone singing music as dark as you always had and then going home and snuggling up with the cat or playing in the backyard with a puppy.
Well, when you're in veterinary medicine, it's not all snuggles, believe me. I mean, it's pretty hardcore. You see a lot of blood and guts and death. And, yeah, it's not all nestling up with the cat. So, and it was in a different direction, and it was really mind-challenging. And, you know, I got my boss totally into Sabbath and Chastain and frickin' Dio, so it was pretty wild.
Now, with Ronnie's passing recently, Ron James Dio, obviously, you and Sandy got back together. Now, I know Sandy had continued working with both Malibu Barbie and a band called War Bride, but she also had graduated from Musician Institute, MI, and was involved with musicals for a band. It's a bit unusual here.
Oh, my God, she's sick. I mean, she wrote a musical. I actually record some of that stuff for her because she always wants to see if we can do it metal, like a metal Ethel Merman.
Wow.
But no, yeah, she really, really got into it. She did a lot of, was a comedy writer for radio. She worked with that great woman from Glee before she was famous, Jane, whatever her name is. Yeah, she never stopped. She was really, really into it. She did really well, got many awards, made lots of money. So she never left the music part of life. And graduating from MI for her was just amazing. I mean, do you listen to that girl's drumming on this freaking record?
Yes.
And it really prepared her. I mean, she had so much to do with, you know, the idea of this record and laying it down properly and being in the studio. And, yeah, she's pretty intense.
So had the two of you been in contact throughout, or was this more out of the blue? Because, you know, a lot of fans, myself included, obviously, had really been hoping for you to reappear, particularly the recent revival of respect for the 80s metal scene.
We had always been in touch. In her defense, it was basically always her, you know. She had always said, you know, we got to do something. She'd come to my house and play me all this stuff and try to get me interested. And so she has always been there.
Right.
But I think, I actually just read something that she had said in an interview, and I found that it was really true. She just kind of laid off for a while, and then we just started hanging out as friends and just kind of getting to know each other that way again. So, you know, I think she knew. I think once it's in your blood, it's always in your blood. And unfortunately, I wish I could change everything and have it have not happened this way. I wish that Ronnie was here to listen to this record, be on this record, tour with us. But I had a moment of clarity when he passed, you know, when I was with her, that was pretty profound, and I just couldn't ignore it. You know, I felt like, I had to do it just, you know, for him. I mean, out of respect for him. I mean, I can sing. That's what the shit I should be doing, right? Yeah.
Exactly right. And you're right. It never leaves you. It's true.
Yeah.
How are you finding your return to music? Are you surprised at how much of the audience isn't even necessarily the old fans like myself, but this new generation who essentially discovered, quote-unquote, real metal via the Internet?
Yeah, it's pretty sick. The Internet, I think, is a catch-22. It's great because I can reach people. You know, I have a bunch of people that are popping up from Iran that love Chastain, and anybody can put music out now. But it's also, how do you get backing now? How do you get the machine behind you, or do you really need the machine behind you? But, yeah, it's kind of the same as when we went to Germany last year. The kids that were there, their age group was frightening to me. And all these people would come up to me, and I said, what, were you listening to me when you were five? I mean, but the exposure is amazing. And, again, you realize what your little corner of the world, how it touched people. I mean, that is freaking cool to think that a record like Mystery of Illusion could have inspired somebody. That's amazing, you know? It's great to think that, you know, like what Ronnie did for my brain, you might do that for someone for a minute. I mean, it's pretty cool.
Exactly. And, you know, it's strange because these things tend to run in 20-year cycles, generally speaking. You know, I remember growing
up.
Well, I remember growing up in the 70s, and there was a lot of nostalgia for the 40s, especially with regards to classic films and the revival circuit.
Yeah.
Then we had the whole 50s thing with American Graffiti, Grease, Sha-na-na. Then the 80s seemed all about looking back with all the conservatism, Cold War and nuclear paranoia, even some McCarthyite stuff like the PMRC and the Mies Commission. Then in the 90s, we had a bit of a 70s thing going on with all the disco and funk coming back. But then when we got the millennium, there wasn't any real revival of 80s stuff. It started building kind of slowly, and I think it's only starting to come to fruition now, a good decade behind schedule, if you will. So any thoughts on why this might be? Because metal never died in Europe or Japan, but, you know, the U.S. has been something of a musical wasteland since around 1991.
I know, and you know what? You're making me think of an interview I saw with Ronnie, like in Switzerland or something, and they were talking to him about that, about how he was like our greatest treasure here. And they're like, how come you don't play here? You know, you're never around that much. And he said, because America has become the land of American Idol, all the work that you have done doesn't matter anymore. What matters
exactly.
is that you're on television and that we've lost sight of it. I don't know. Why is it that I went to Germany and those people are so metal and so hungry? Is it the age of their country? Do they have less than we do? I don't know. Is there less of a machine there? I don't know. I can't answer that for you. I don't know. But I certainly,
yeah.
Sledge and I have considered actually just moving over there. You know, I don't know.
Because I ask that of just about every band I talk to because I don't get it. And I'm trying to see what everybody's perspective is, see if anybody has any insight into this. Because it's like, why?
And, you know, aren't we always hopping on the new trend? What's young? What's beautiful? What's fresh?
Right.
I don't know. It's pretty sick.
Now, let's get a little more in-depth on Sledge Weather. So what is the title Imagine Me Alive really referring to? Is it a statement of surprise that you're still here with us and back on the scene? Or is there a deeper meaning?
That's a good one, Gene, but it actually came from that song that she had actually in her head when we went to Germany. She was already putting in her iPhone, and it's what came to her after the passing of the Rev, the drummer from Avenged Sevenfold, who Sledge loves that band, not
right.
so much their music, but the way their career is gone, what they do, their intelligence. I mean, she just loves them. And when he passed, it was something that came to her, and she also helped me realize that I guess he was really the foundation of that band and all their material, and so she kind of wrote that in homage to him, and then everything just started coming about, you know, people that leave us too fast, and,
right.
you know, not to, then Ronnie leaves, and it's like, let's not forget them and their contribution to the world and how they touched us, and, you know, you close your eyes and they're still here, so, you know, it was about somebody leaving, yeah.
You'd also recruited longtime Dio bassist Jimmy Bain for the record. So how did you swing that one?
Oh, my God, Jimmy frickin' Bain. Sandy, again, she lives in L.A., and she started running into him, I believe. She was running into him in, like, Ralph's at the grocery store. And, I mean, they would always talk, and she finally said to him one day, as she will tell you when you talk to her, as a drummer, as a metal drummer, and what we're really into and where we come from, she wants to play with Jimmy Bain. That's the kind of bass player she wants. So she finally just said it to him, you know, and he remembered us from back in the day, too, when he was with Ronnie. And he's like, you know, Leather and I are doing this project. We'd like you to be on it. And he said, well, let me hear the stuff. And he heard the stuff, and he's like, okay. I mean, it was that simple, and the same with Scott Warren.
Wow.
They just really liked the material, and, you know, they've been around a long time. So
yes.
I think they still come from that classic place, you know, where they want songs, and they don't necessarily want speed and yelling and screaming, but they were
right.
just really on board for the music, yeah?
So I understand that in your current tour, you're covering songs that span your career, Rude Girl stuff, Malibu Barbie stuff, Chastain stuff, the Shockwaves material. I find that
we don't do any Shockwaves material, Gene.
Nothing, really?
No. And I was saying, you know, if and when we really start going out, I would like to, but, yeah, no, we do, of course, what we call the Chastain hits, which is really funny, Angel of Mercy, Voice of the Cult, huge, huge songs for people that know us. When Lightning Strikes from Malibu Barbie, we have done The Gallows, which is a Rude Girl song that a lot of people don't know about, but when they
right.
hear it, they like it. Taste of Night is actually an old Rude Girl song that we revamped, so yeah.
Because, yeah, I find that pretty refreshing, because too many bands and musicians tend to focus just on the current album or project and kind of poo-poo the material that brought them to prominence in the first place. And I find it's much better when there's a mix.
You know, I know, and you're slapping me in the face as you say that, because I kind of think, God, I want to move away from this Chastain stuff, but you know what? Why? And I can't. I mean, why should I be so selfish? For Those Who Dare, Angel of Mercy. I mean, Angel of Mercy got a lot of hype, too, because of Hammerfall doing it. So,
right.
I mean, yeah, I mean, those songs go over so big, and you know, those are two pretty good songs. So, as Chastain was saying, you'll never get away from it.
Yeah, because I just think that it's better when there's a mix, and it's also better promotion, because everyone can see how well the new material fits into the repertoire, as opposed to just saying, that didn't exist.
Yeah. And, you know, we have so much stuff, and we're so proud of it. My God, we should, you know, we could play for 3 hours. I mean...
Exactly.
Yeah, you certainly can't. Well, you know, I think of all these big bands, a lot of pop bands, they're like, oh, my God, they're so sick of singing their hits or whatever. How can you be sick of it, man? You know, look
exactly.
in the audience and see how you affect them. How can you be sick of that? But, yeah.
Right. The new material's a bit more modernistic than what you were doing back in the 80s, but your vocals are very much in the same ballpark. There's a bit of a ragged feel to the slower tracks, like One Glimpse and Torch, that reminds me of a cross between Kim Carnes and Bonnie Raitt. My father would absolutely love those.
Interesting, because it almost, yeah, I almost did want it to come off, and I am far from a blues singer, but I wanted it to come off that way, and as you can tell with Torch, how it sounds like an old 40s
right.
record thing, and that totally happened by mistake, the way we recorded it, and the way we had the piano mic'd. God, we were going, oh my God, and then it was, you know, 2-3 in the morning, and we were like, wow, and we wanted it to be, again, it's about a person kind of moving through their own history, and it's like, hey, so this was back then, you know, and One Glimpse kind of has that megaphone almost, I'm so proud of the way that came out. One Glimpse is a song that Sandy had written quite a while ago. It was a really old song that she had written, and she said that she kept it for me. So, and I will always do ballads. I'm a ballad freak, you know, because I can sing them. I will always do a ballad, yeah.
So that was actually an accident. I'm sure you put the crackles in afterwards, but that wasn't...
No,
you know, you didn't intend
that
from the start?
It was recorded that way, and we were first like, shh, God damn it, you know? But then... It was perfect. We listened to it, and we didn't change a thing. Would you believe we recorded that at her home, and we never changed any of it?
Really?
We just put it on the record. We just, you know, whatever. I don't know how she did it. But, yeah, we didn't. That was done in her studio, the mic going through her kitchen, hanging over the kitchen table, hanging over the piano at, like, 2 in the morning, and we kept it that way.
But the, like I said, the vocals on those, that kind of ragged feel to it, it reminds me of this girl's name, Kim Carnes and Bonnie Raitt. And my father
absolutely loved
those.
Yeah, that's great.
He had a thing for ladies who had a sort of smoker's voice like that. So, but when you really open up your throat and let it rip, it's like Chastain, Malibu, Barbie, or Shockwaves all over again. And I really like the title track and Lost Forgiveness in particular, but the whole album is really impressive.
Yeah, you know, thanks. I mean, damn, you know, we did okay. And like I said, we never had the opportunity to do it before. And so I think we've got nothing to lose now, you know, and we did it ourselves. It's all our own finances and our own time. And yeah, I mean, it was really exciting. And now we're starting to plan out the second one. I mean, it's just a great time. You know, we're older, we're wiser. We know what we want. And now we can do it. Now we can't wonder, you know, I don't have to wonder, oh shit, can I sing that? Yeah, I can. And she can play it. So
yeah, that's great.
Yeah, it's great.
And of course, with the sort of Pro Tools mix that you're utilizing here, the drums are more or less front and center as well. So we get to hear how good Sandy really is. It's not like in
old
days.
Well, that's Juan Ortega too, dude. I mean, that's what we loved about him. Those machine head drums. Oh my God,
right.
He did. I'm not sure if he did all or some of the drums on the New Testament record, but he's just a freak. So when I heard that, and you know. You listen to a lot of stuff and you can't hear the drums or it's a horrible sound.
Exactly.
And I was tired of the Chastain days. What did you hear? Me Once in a While and Chastain. I mean, I was
done
with that.
That was it, right. So why all the short interludes on the album? Because if you include Torch for its brevity, there's 5 in all out of 11 tracks. It almost makes it an EP in effect.
That came about again. You're making me envision Sledge and I in the studio in her backyard. And something came up about these little pieces. I don't really remember what the conversation was, but she said, you know, I want to do that. I want to do that in between each song, so let's start thinking about that. And we just wanted it to be this running kind of like, you know, we like Supertramp back in the day, and they used to do that, Pink Floyd. It would just run into each other. And I don't know. That was like divine intervention. I mean, that thing just happened. And then Scott Warren with those great keyboard effects. And
right.
It really just came together quite easily, so I have a feeling that the new one probably won't. But, you know, like I said, Sledge said that the other day to someone. We got nothing to lose. Nothing. Just go for it. Just do it. Do what you want to do, you know. No labels barking at my door. Do it this way. Do it this way. We can do whatever the hell we want.
There's a strong focus on religion on this record. The guy upstairs lied, her father's daughter. Beyond the fact that you obviously grew up a good Italian Catholic like myself, what is this all about? What inspired you to adopt such a strong focus in this area on your comeback record?
Well, you know what? I have not. That's your interpretation. We have not. That's your interpretation. That's great. The guy upstairs lied is literally about the band. Me, Matt, and Sandy were in a situation last year when we were writing this record. There was so much frickin' noise upstairs, and it wasn't supposed to be up there. The guy up there told us something, and I walked in and said, that motherfucker lied. And that just created the song. And I know a lot of people would think about it that way. And then, of course, as you get into writing, it kind of evolves into that. But literally, the guy upstairs pounding when we were trying to write drum track. That was that. Father's daughter came about actually in a couple of different ways. Yeah, that is religious, Italian Catholic. Yeah, how can we get away from that? Every freaking thing
exactly.
I write is about Jesus. But that was really, I had lost my father, and then Ronnie had passed, and yeah, I just related it to that, and he was like a father figure to me, so that just came out of that. And it is, that is kind of religious. the way it sounds, I wasn't thinking about that, but yeah, it's kind of just someone coming into their own and having a bunch of power, and you wonder where it comes from. And yeah, that was me insinuating that Dad was God and that I learned from him. Yeah, I guess that's true, yeah.
And I was actually wondering if it was something of a reaction to all this Republicanism and hate-based conservatism that's been festering across the country lately, too.
Sledge will tend to write about politics, and you know, because she's so bitter and pissed off about it. But you're right. I am so stuck in Catholicism. You know, I think that's probably what attracts me to Ronnie's material so much. I mean, I got to get out of it. She even said that to me. How come everything is heaven and hell in black and white, and with me, I always want to go home because she's Jewish? But, you know, I mean, as a woman, and I am not whining at all, but I think as a female in the 70s and 80s, growing up in a Catholic Italian family in upstate New York, I mean, I thought I was going to hell all the time,
It
had a reaction.
It takes one to know one, you know, Italian Catholic. I know exactly where that's coming from. I heard it.
That's funny. Yeah, but the guy upstairs, no. But I knew people would think about that. And the Lost Forgiveness was a really intense song that Sledge wrote when she was in Prague after I had left her in Germany, because she could stay there longer and she went on her way. And she, you know, has a heartfelt feeling for all this stuff because, again, she is Jewish. And, you know, she said she was just sitting in this amazing city looking at all these religious icons and then realizing what people freaking do to each other. So that came out of that. I mean, that's a tight song. You can tell the emotion that she wrote that with.
Very much so.
And I really, that was a tough song for me because she really wanted that to be perfect and I wanted it to be perfect for her. So that was a pretty intense song for me to record, yeah.
You also focus on mortality with A Taste of Night, you know, before eternal sleep, the moments are so brief. Yeah, it's strange how when you're in your teens, everyone seems to be in love with this idea of death or what have you. We're all thinking about it so much. But as you get on in life, it suddenly gets more scary and real. You know, we develop friendships, love lives, families, and now we got something to
read. Yeah, and again, that song is something to do with death.
Really?
That song, it's funny how the words come out, right? That song was written back in the day when we used to rehearse up at Haight Ashbury, up on the corner at Haight Ashbury, Rude Girl. We were there. Metallica was down the street. Suicidal Tendencies would always be around. We'd eat at the same pizza shop. And that was just about a bunch of girls being young and wild and running around Haight Street after rehearsal, you know, eating pizza in the same place as Hetfield did. I mean, it was just about running around and being crazy, just being on the prowl. I'm coming to get you. I'm going to be as good as you. I'm going to be on the road with you. Yeah.
You know, usually
and it was also about
like
being horny a little bit too. But it's funny how people, you know, it's beautiful that people have their own ideas, but it, you know, had nothing to do with death at all.
Fascinating. Usually when I give people my interpretation, it's like, oh yeah, that's right, or I didn't think about that, it was a good point. You're like, nah, it's not really it, it's really about the Kevin pizza.
we were just running around partying, trying to hang out with the big boys, man. And we were on the prowl, we were coming for you. Yeah.
And then that fades into One Glimpse, which seems to be about encountering ghosts.
Yeah, that is Sledge. Like I said, that's her song, and that was written about the ghosts thing. And you'll see, this is why this all kind of fit in. But it was about ghosts and, you know, people trying to get in touch with you, whatever you believe in. But she's really heavy into that. And she had played that for me one time, and I was just floored. I'm like, we have to do that song. We played it a little bit, and then we went and we demoed it. And that last line where I said, but I want you to, you're haunting me, but I want you to, that wasn't in there. And again,
really?
I do my best work when I'm exhausted. I was like 2 in the morning, and I just did that. And she just had this epiphany. She was like, oh, my God. So, yeah, but that was really about ghosts and, you know, people haunting you. And so
I
that one's
found
right.
That to be the most haunting line, so it's funny that you just threw that in last second.
Yeah. And again, you know, I tend to be a bit corny sometimes about that, but, you know, Dio leaving this planet really had, I know in the whole world, but it really got me. So when we were creating these songs, and again, Dad died, so, you know, yeah, it's just your emotion. It's the way you're feeling at the time.
So apropos of all this sort of morbid introspection, you utilize a lot of dreamy, gothic-style delay effects, whispers, voices and guitars fading in and out, volume swells, phase effects. It's very creepy. It sets this kind of claustrophobic mood that the material seems to be reaching for.
Exactly what we wanted it to be, creepy. Yeah. Yeah, we like those. And some people that we know that are like high up in management stuff are saying, well, you know, you can't, your second record, you can't keep making the first record. And we're like, oh, yes, we can. But yeah, we wanted it to be thought provoking. And yeah, it's about ghosts and people leaving you and me trying to fix my past life. So I'm glad. And again, Sandy was so Herd Juan together were so influential in creating this. I mean, they did a really good job. I just kind of sat back and said, yeah, okay, I like it. We'll try. I mean, you know, it's just amazing.
The Lost Forgiveness, this one in particular, felt very dramatic in like a Dior Iron Maiden sense. But what was strange is it seemed like it would be a long track, but you've very consciously chosen to keep all your songs fairly brief, almost like they were crafted specifically for radio airplay. So was there any thought given to that?
No, there wasn't, but we kind of say that sometimes too, saying, God, thank God that we aren't like signed and have to do rock radio, because one of the songs have to be 5 minutes. That's
right.
Just the way we write, and I kind of really like the idea that the record was short. Neither one of us have a large attention span is what we say. You know, so that's where it's based from. I say short and sweet. You know, I like to go out and play 30-minute sets. Good night. You know, I mean, I think that's just really what our demeanor is. We don't sit around and think about it, but sometimes we would have to add parts to make it longer. We should be in a punk band.
I know, right? I can actually...
15-second song.
There's some bands out there, and it just goes on and on. It's like, you know, this is a nice song, but I'm getting bored, and you don't get that here.
Yeah, we do have a song, a Rude Girl song, that will go on and on and on, but Sledge says she's saving that for record number 3. But, I mean, we do have those jam moments. But, yeah, I mean, again, that's our personality, short and sweet.
And what's strange about the record to me, beyond the interludes and its overall brevity, is that while I hear a lot of King Diamond-style, European, neoclassical, inflected guitar fills throughout the album, I don't believe there were any proper solos outside of The Man Upstairs Lied. Was this a conscious...
Oh, thank you. I used to say to Matthias all the time, dude, but I come from a different school. I'm like, where's the solo? But the beauty about him was he was such a song-oriented guitar player. I'd never experienced that. He'd be like, it doesn't fit in the song. It doesn't fit in the song.
Okay.
He is not, and I say it in a loving way, a masturbatory guitar player. He just was into, I think that's why we fell in love with him. He was into the rhythms, and yeah, I used to say the same thing to him, but he didn't want to be showcased if it didn't highlight the song, is what he said, and it didn't fit in. We didn't write that way, so.
It had to be deliberate, because it's like you hear the fills all over the place, and then there's really nothing when it comes to, okay, this should be a solo section. No, it just goes.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
But, like I said, it's a very impressive album overall, and particularly the fact that, you know, you look and sound just as good as ever. It's surprising that
nothing really seems to have changed
after such a long break from performance. You know, you figure, okay, well, you know, it's been 20 years out of the business. But no, it's just like you picked up from, you know, 1991 again.
Yeah. Well, you know, like we said about Sledge, she went to school and she never stopped. She's continued to work out and grow as a drummer. For me, you know, it's a blessing from wherever it comes from. Someone was saying that to me the other day about people that are putting out records on 20 years later and they don't sound as good. And I'm like, well, you know what? I didn't do anything for 20 years. I didn't trash my voice for 20 years. They have. So I've been really blessed. You know, I don't know. I kind of don't question it. I just let it happen. I didn't sing at all in the downtime when we decided that we were going to really start doing this and I started going in to do demos. I mean, I got to tell you, some of it was frightening. There were many CDs that I burnt, let me tell you, because I didn't want anybody here. So, I mean, it didn't go in the studio, and we were like, yeah. I mean, I did have to work back up to it, and I actually went to see a vocal coach a couple times, which I had never done before, to kind of get back into it. But, yeah, I mean, it can be a hard life. But, you know, again, when it's in you, man. I mean, I'll always find a way to do it.
And I tell you, it definitely paid off. So do you have anything you want to plug? Are there any upcoming tours you got scheduled, or do you want to point the listeners to your website or Facebook page?
Yes, please. Everyone that wants to know anything about Sledge Leather can go to sledgeleather.com. You can get to Facebook from there, YouTube from there. We played a couple shows in L.A. recently, which is all on YouTube. We did a great show at the House of Blues. We are now basically just planning our second record, you know, so you can buy the Imagine Me Alive from us directly under the merchandising thing at sledgeleather.com. You can buy it on iTunes, Spotify, all those wonderful e-music things that they have. I don't even know what they are. And we will just keep everybody posted. We are trying to hook up with some festivals next year. Again, it's all really, really hard. I think it's going to take us a while, but we'll get out there. Our priority is to just keep making great music, which we can do on our own.
Right.
So, again, we are beginning to plan out the new record as we speak, yeah.
Well, with that, Leather, I'd like to thank you for joining me here on Third Eye Cinema. It was a real pleasure. And I'd certainly love to have you back on to discuss your next album.
I'll be calling you. You're 17th on my list when the next one comes out. Thank you so much, Gene.
Thank you.
Metal up. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us tonight. We hope you enjoyed our interview with Leather Leone. We'll be back in 2 weeks for week 38 of Third Eye Cinema. Coming in the near future, we'll have a power metal tribute with Gordon O'Gon and Mob Rules. And also, Hope Stansbury will be talking to Andy Milligan. If you'd like to contact us here, comments, suggestions, or if you're a filmmaker or musician that would like to join us on air, email us at thirdeyecinema@hotmail.com. Those are
visit our Facebook page, facebook.com/Third Eye Cinema, or our new website, thirdeyecinema.wordpress.com. Third Eye Cinema, thank you. Page for links to the shows in question. All Blog Talk Radio shows are available for archive listener download at your convenience. See you in 2 weeks.